Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have back here on the program Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Once a month, we have been doing these programs for a long time to give you the chance to ask questions about home maintenance. Got some kind of problem and you're not quite sure how to solve it, give us a call and Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we got somebody here ready to go, hopefully, pretty quick, and we'll get as many as we can. Hey, thanks for being here.
Good morning, David. I'm glad to be here.
Something I thought I'd ask you to weigh in on. Last week, Ed Kieser was here on the program. We were talking about winter weather. The idea is that that was the week, last week was the week in Illinois and Indiana that the government says to people, winter's coming, you ought to be prepared. So somebody called in and put out this hypothetical question and said, well, what if it's winter, it's cold, and your power goes out? Is there anything in particular that you should do in your house, for your house, to try to mitigate any potential kind of damage that might result because it's cold, maybe below freezing, and now you don't have any heat?
Well, yes, there are a couple of things you can do. First of all, when we drop below freezing, the first problem we have is water. So if the house is going to be without power for any long period of time, we had ice storm back in the early 90s. It was, I think, we had houses out of power for 7 days. Mm-hmm. If that's going to be the case, what I would actually recommend is going and see if you can find an auxiliary generator and have somebody help wire in one and give you some additional power so you can run a furnace or something like that. Most of the time, the furnace is being gas, but do run with electric motors and electric valves for the gas. So it doesn't take much power to run a furnace, but it does take electricity. So a backup generator is always a good idea. But if the house is literally no power and no way of getting power to it, first thing you want to do is shut the water off and start draining some of the water lines. The water lines, the traps, things like that are where you're going to end up with problems and damage the house. Most of the rest of the house is not going to necessarily be significantly damaged by freezing. Mm-hmm. You can get some drying and cracking of plaster walls and some movement of things, but it's nothing that's going to be so serious as to have to repair anything other than cosmetic issues.
So how long before you would have to worry about water freezing in the traps? How long would you have to be without power and it have been below freezing?
That is all going to depend on how tight the house is and how well insulated it is. I know in my house, I did some checking last time we had a power outage, and it was a good 18 hours to let the house drop down 11, 12 degrees. And it was when it was one of these days when it was 15 or 20 degrees outside. Mm-hmm. So depending on how much mass is in the house, how much furniture and stuff, all that holds heat. Of course, your basement and stuff, or if you've got a basement, is going to be 55 or so degrees pretty much year-round just from the heat from the soil. So things like that can act as a heat source. So there's any number of different factors. So there's no one way of saying, hey, you've got X number of hours from the time the power goes out to the time things are going to freeze. It all depends on how cold the air is outside, what the temperatures are, how high, how much wind is blowing, because the wind or air leakage in the house is actually what's going to help dry things out or cool things down.
Yeah. So really, then it sounds like really the big thing that you don't want to happen is you don't want to have any pipes freeze and break, because then you could have real serious mess and a lot of expense in having it fixed.
If you think it might get close to it and you're not feeling like going and pulling all the traps, because they're really not expensive to change most traps. What you can do is turn the main water supply off to the house, mm-hmm. and then open the water valves and just let them drain out. Most of the time when you get frozen pipes, it's not because an entire pipe froze. Usually there's a pinpoint someplace where air has blown onto it, and we end up with an ice plug. Mm-hmm. And when that ice plug expands, mm-hmm. if it expands against a closed valve, then it will build up a hydraulic pressure, and the hydraulic pressure is what's going to break your line. So by opening the valves, then you give that water someplace to go, so therefore it doesn't sit there and just build up all the pressure And I think it takes about 3,000 pounds of pressure to actually burst a copper pipe.
Okay, very good. Well, other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a couple callers here ready to go, starting with someone in Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Good morning. I promised my husband I would call the first time I heard you on. Either our garage is going up or the concrete apron leading up to the garage is sinking, but there is an increasingly great height difference between the floor of the garage and the concrete apron.
How old is the house?
Oh, probably 15 years.
Okay. Most likely your apron is dropping a little bit.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah, the apron is set on some loose soil, what they call fill soil.
Mm-hmm.
When they built the house, they had to build up to get the driveway up.
And
with time, if they didn't get that real compacted or get enough sand and gravel in there, you can get some drop. If it becomes significant enough where obviously it's a bump where the car doesn't want to go in and things like that.
Yeah, he's just about at that point.
Okay. Well, there is a couple of different ways of doing it. The most common one is what they call mud jacking, and this is a method where they drill some relatively small holes in the concrete, probably for a two-car garage apron. They're probably looking at four or five holes,
uh-huh.
And they hook up a fitting to those holes, and then they hydraulically force a concrete sand water type mixture underneath the slab and basically float it or lift it back up into place. It's not a terribly expensive process. It's definitely much less expensive than breaking out the apron and having it re-poured. Usually I don't want to quote prices for them because obviously I don't do the work, but usually you're looking at about $300 to $400 for something like that.
Oh, that's not bad.
And that way you can lift it back up. Now, you don't want to lift it up too high because there is also going to be some frost heave. I mean, if you bring it back, depending on the time of year, most of the guys that do this are pretty versed at being able to figure out how far they can or can't go. Depending on the time of year, we get some freeze-thaw action, and you will actually get that to lift up.
Yeah, we might be going down into the garage as opposed to
correct.
Into the garage. So is there, I mean, could we do it now? Is it better to wait till spring? What's the timeline on something like this?
I don't see any reason why it couldn't be done now, particularly if it's something that's bothering you.
Okay.
I mean, we haven't got into any hard freezing weather, so it does take the concrete a little bit of time to dry underneath there. But once it's pumped under the slab, it does pick up the natural heat from the ground, so it tends to cure itself.
Okay. That sounds great. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And the next caller is in Lafayette, line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
This is theoretical. I think I know that 2 amperes of current times the standard 120 volts consumes 240 watts.
Okay.
Or about a quarter of a kilowatt hour over a period of an hour.
Okay.
Okay, then I can figure my costs.
You're just trying to figure an energy cost on an
mm-hmm.
item? Yeah.
Okay, my practical question is how an inverter used by our Amish neighbors can convert battery power, DC, into AC current enough to run small appliances like hand drills and coffee makers and microwave ovens.
Well, as far as the electronics goes, they actually make inverters that you can use. A lot of the truck drivers particularly use 1,500-watt or 2,000-watt inverters so that they can run small coffee makers and things like that inside their semi-trucks.
But how can they get all that power out of a battery?
Well,
for any length of time.
It does require a fairly high current draw on the battery. Basically, they're using a primary and a secondary coil and using a voltage step-up system. I'll be quite honest, it's been so long since I've gotten into the actual electronics, I used to do a bunch of electronics before I started doing home inspections, but I can't come up with the answer right off the top of my head.
Well, it just seems disproportionate.
It does require quite a bit of the DC current to produce a little bit of AC current, so I won't say it's really efficient.
So aren't they forever replacing or recharging their batteries?
Yes. Yeah, and usually what they'll have is some type of a generator system. On a diesel truck, you've got a generator or an alternator in most cases that will recharge the battery. But, the alternator does not put out a clean AC current. So by using the inverter, you actually get an AC current that can be regulated so that you don't end up with voltage spikes and such.
Okay. Well, that helps, sort of. Thank you.
All right. All right. Thank you. On to Bloomington. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. We have a question regarding tankless water heaters. Do you recommend tankless water heaters?
There are a lot of places where a tankless water heater works quite well. There are other things where the tankless water heater doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense. Generally speaking, if you've got a household with multiple people and the water heater generally centrally located, I would say it's not necessarily the most efficient way of changing things if you've already got a water heater in place. Now, if you don't have a water heater in place, such as new construction, then there's something to be considered. But an instant hot water heater is designed to bring the water temperature up a certain degree. Let's say the water coming out of the ground is 55 degrees and we need to bring it up to 180 degrees. We get one that can raise that, the 125 degrees, to get up to where we want it to be. Unfortunately, if we get places like Colorado where the water comes out of the ground at closer to 40 degrees, then we've got to have a bigger heater to get the temperature up. Otherwise, you end up with a little bit of cool water instead of hot water. So a lot depends on the application. Oftentimes, I've recommended the instantaneous units as a secondary where you've got a master bedroom or a master bathroom that is located a long distance away from the primary water heater. You can use the instant on so that when you start your shower, you have hot water, and let it draw off of the primary hot water heater so that it doesn't have to keep the water quite as warm once you've got the water flowing.
So, well, how do you find out the temperature of your water coming into the house?
Well, usually when you get them installed, that they've got a pretty even setting, a temperature setting of what your output is. But how much water are we needing? Are we needing enough hot water for a family of four where we're running the dishwasher and trying to take a shower?
There's just two of us.
Mm-hmm. There are ways of sizing the units. It's one of those things I'd probably have to go on and Google. I have not actually done it much sizing with them because I actually use a standard water heater. I'm single, so my house does not require a lot of hot water, and everybody's like, well, an instant one, you don't have to store water. But I found from my inspections that the storage tanks that we have nowadays on a standard 40-gallon water heater will actually hold heat well enough that just a single pilot light will raise the temperature of the water higher than what the burner is set at if the house is left unoccupied. All too often, I get into an empty house, and I go to turn the water on, and it's almost scalding because the pilot light is enough to keep the water in the tank warm. So I don't know how much energy savings there is by not having this 40-gallon tank of hot water, as long as it's well-insulated. The older the water heater is, the less efficient it is, the less insulation it's got, the more sense it would make to switch over to something else.
Because we know we need to replace our we currently have, you know, a natural gas 40-gallon water heater that we know will soon need to be replaced. And well, the tankless, do they require, you know, special venting or anything?
Well, it depends whether you not get an electric unit or whether or not you're getting a gas unit. If you're getting a gas unit, they do make a direct vent style where you can run it through a PVC pipe and out through a wall, or they make some that are a little less efficient that you can connect up to your standard Class B gas vent. One of the things you might look into is, okay, how much energy savings can I actually get on a tankless versus a tank type? Because if you've already got everything plumbed and set up for a standard 40-gallon water heater, a replacement unit is approximately $300, whereas most of these tankless units are up in the $1,000 to $1,100 range. So how long is it going to take you to recover $800 in excess expenses? My guess is it's probably not going to happen. I don't think you can save $800 over the life of the water heater to make up for the amount of that it's going to cost you to upgrade to that type of water heater.
What's the easiest way to figure, you know, the energy savings between a tankless versus a? I mean, I understand that there are high efficiency conventional water heaters.
Yeah, there's 90% of direct vent or induced draft water heaters as well.
Uh-huh.
So it's, I'll be honest, I haven't done a lot of the research on the value. Most of our research on homes is when my father was with the University Small Homes Council, and I was able to get a lot of that research. I haven't been over there lately to see if they've done any studies on the tankless water heaters, and I have not done any research on that. It is something that has come up here on the program a couple of times, so I guess that means I need to go back to the office and get Hank working on, see if we can't come up with some stats and some figures.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Now, isn't it not the case that for now, at least for conventional water heaters, it should say on there what their estimate for what it would cost to run it for a year? That should be right on the water heater.
Yes, there is an energy savings guide on there that tells you what the energy or projected energy use using a national average. And how much gas it should use, and then you have to figure out how much the gas in our area is costing at that point in time and multiply it out by what they're claiming it's going to use. Mm-hmm. And so there should be a way of calculating out. It's something that I have not looked into. But like I said, this is, I think, the second or third time that we've run across this, so I'm going to go back and do a little research.
All right. Well, maybe on a future program we can talk some more about the relative merits of tankless heaters, water heaters. All right. Well, in the meantime, here, let's talk with somebody in Paris. Line one. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
I'm just asking a simple question, I think. I have a little bit of mildew in one corner of the bathroom. And what is the magic solution to washing that off successfully and discouraging more?
Okay. Well, a lot of it depends on what type of surface it is growing on. If the mildew is in the silicone or in the sealant around the tub tile, then you may need...
It's an upper corner. It's an upper corner.
So it's like a drywall corner.
Yeah, but what do I wash it with? Your father had a solution.
Yeah, usually about a quarter of a cup of a bleach to...
A cup of bleach.
Yeah, with...
To how much water?
Usually it's one part bleach, four parts water, so... One part bleach to four parts water.
Oh, one part bleach to four parts water. Well, that I don't know why I don't have that. I've heard it before.
Yeah, that should take care of most of it.
I bet you that something's happened above that to let it get cool. You know, some of the insulation or something.
That would be my guess, yes, that you've got a little bit of a cold spot in the wall from some insulation settling or something like that.
Is that a big thing to should I worry about that, or should I just wash off that little corner and get rid of the mildew? It's probably more expensive to go up there and check it out, right?
It can be quite difficult to insulate inside a wall that's already got insulation into. There's no real access to get more insulation into it. So
yeah, I've got a lot of insulation up there.
Up in the attic. Mm-hmm. And this is this on the wall or at the ceiling?
It's on the ceiling next to the outside wall in a corner there.
My guess, you might if you've got somebody available that's able to go up into the attic and look if it's accessible. My guess is the wind may have blown back a little bit of insulation. We get some of these high winds, winter storms, and such that goes up through your soffit vents, and you can actually blow some of the insulation back at the edges, and you end up with a thin spot or a cold spot up there. And it's not that difficult to push the insulation back over the top of it. The other thing is
just have somebody look at it, and maybe they could just fix it. At the same time.
Yeah.
It's just a small place.
Yeah, it's quite likely
And you think it's worthwhile doing that?
To at least take a look at it, yes. It all depends on how accessible it is. If it's a fairly simple attic, it should be a fairly simple procedure to go up there and say a little bit of insulation is blown out, or possibly that where the vent for the bathroom fan goes out, that there's a place we could add a little bit of insulation. So, yes, it should be fairly simple.
It's not a floored attic. It has no floor. You have to walk on the beams. So it's not real simple, but it's not real difficult either.
Well, usually when
beams.
usually when putting insulation back in place, a non-floored attic is much easier than a floored attic because it's very difficult to see underneath the floorboards, where if it's all open, then it's usually fairly simple to see whether or not the insulation has been moved out of place. I've found it from squirrels or from wind or any number of different things that can give you a cold spot.
You think it would be worth doing?
Well, I'd clean the spot off, and if it does seem to be a cold spot, the attic's not difficult to get to, if you don't have to take the entire closet apart or something, and you've got somebody available to do that.
Oh, we've got a hole up there to crawl through.
Okay, it would be a good idea to go up and take a look at it and see if maybe there is a possibility of some missing insulation.
Okay, I'll do that. I thank you for your advice.
All right, thank you.
I count on your advice.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580 is Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month. It's always a Monday to talk about home maintenance issues. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And obviously what's happening there is that you've got a bathroom, you've got a moist environment, there's moisture in the air. If there's a cold spot, it'll condense, and then you'll get a spot where it'll be damp and mildew likes that, so that's obviously what's happening.
Yep, that is correct, yeah. Cold spots can be created by a number of different things, missing insulation, pinpoint air leaks, an opening, a crack in a piece of siding or a soffit. The missing insulation can be from wind moving the insulation back. It can be from that hole in the roof that you had 5 years ago that a squirrel snuck in there and tried to nest in a corner. So, I mean, there's any number of different things. So, usually if you've got condensation in one spot, you've got two things. One, you've got a cold spot. The other, you've got a humidity source. So you look for both of them.
Yeah. All right. Let's take another call here. Somebody on cell phone, line two. Hello.
Hi, more about insulation, and I was kind of wondering about, I don't know, I'm interested in, like, super insulating an already existing structure, which I can't find really anything about on the web, but starting with roof, since we're talking about it, I've got, like, fiberglass floaty stuff, kind of just, you know, they blown in fiberglass in the attic, and I wonder, A, how difficult is it to replace it with something more reliable, and then bumping it up with something like cellulose, and then B, is there any way to go past the standard 19 with your walls? Let's say they're already 4 inches thick. I mean, is there anything at all that can be done?
Well, there's always ways that you can do additional things and add more insulation. The question is where do they no longer become cost-effective? Where does the insulation value gained no longer pay for the amount of energy saved? The R value, or insulating value, is basically an inverse proportion to heat loss. If you've got an R19 wall, 1/19th of the heat that gets to that wall over a given time frame passes through it. The rest of it is effectively reflected back. So once you get an R38, now all of a sudden we're not losing as much. As a matter of fact, the difference between an R19 wall and an R38, we're working with fractions. Sounds to me like 1/38th of the heat loss that we were getting, we're actually saving by adding another 6 inches. So it's one of those things where super insulating only works if you have super cold, where we have to worry about the heat loss. The more insulation you get, the less return you get on. If you've already got a house that has, say, an R30 in the attic, my guess is it's not worth putting another 6 inches insulation in it, because the insulation is going to cost you more than what you're going to save in energy.
Okay, so I guess I'm confused because, I mean, this is like people who build homes specifically to do this, but like... you can find the Rocky Mountain Institute build a house with like R value walls 40 and ceiling 80, and it's got like lots of solar penetration, and this house is essentially heating itself in the mountains in Colorado. It seems to me that shouldn't be the only place where you can do that. If you've got great southern exposure, there should be a limit at which, okay, if you've got this much insulation, then it is worth it, because you're not going to have to heat the house hardly at all, and rather than, you know, $200 in a month in the summer. And maybe in the winter. I'm just confused. I there must be some point at which you can really dramatically change things, and maybe I'm mistaken.
Oh, you can make quite a bit of difference by adding more insulation. The question is, at what point does it get to where it's no longer feasible or cost effective to do it? Because to spend $300,000 to insulate a house and make it completely airtight is not going to save you and you're saving $200 a month in fuel costs. I don't see where this is going to work. I mean, there is definitely a way to add more insulation and make the house tighter and seal things up. The other problem is, as soon as you start making a super insulated house or a super tight house with no air movement, then we start having to do more mold and mildew problems, which is what a lot of the new construction is now. We're building them tighter and tighter and less airflow. And now the humidity that we produce just by living in the house, cooking, sure, cleaning, showering, talking, et cetera, is not leaving the house. So we end up with we got to start worrying about moisture control as soon as we start getting the house too tight.
Do you know if there are any firms in this area that specialize in this type of question, how to optimize, minimize the problem of the moisture, minimize the cost, maximize, give you that sweet spot? Is there anyone here who's trying to work on that problem that you know of, like a firm that you could just say, come on, analyze my house, let's see? You may not know. Maybe it just doesn't exist, but I'm kind of wondering.
I am not familiar with any in this area. That's one where you're welcome to give our office a call, and we can, since my father was doing building research for over 35 years, that's one that I'm sure he probably has some contacts where I may not know it, but he can probably find out who does.
All right. Well, if it exists, I'd like to know about it, and, thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. We will continue here. Again, we're a little bit past our midpoint. We have time for certainly other calls. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. That's the number to call. Toll free, 800-222-9455. That's our monthly show on home maintenance. Scott Spies is here from the Spies Home Inspection Service. Next is someone in Urbana. Line one, right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Recently, I listened to a sales talk by someone who was selling an insulation material, which to me at least sounded very suspect, but I thought I would get your opinion of the material. It seemed to be a heavy-duty aluminum foil, which they essentially wanted to put in the attic and claimed it would be a wonder product.
Reflective insulations of something that is not new. There's been a lot of work done and a lot of research done on reflective insulation. The reflective insulation returns diminish with the more insulation you've already got up in the attic. If you've got an attic that has minimal insulation, yes, reflective insulation is something that will help.
It's a double layer of fiberglass bats.
Yeah, if you've already got 8 to 10 inches of insulation up there, usually 8 inches is roughly an R30. The amount of saving you're going to get with a reflective insulation is questionable. If you had an R19 or if you had an R11 bat, yes, some reflective insulation would work well. Basically what it is it's using the heat rising up through the insulation. They're trying to reflect back down through the insulation.
Yeah.
If you haven't got a lot of heat loss through there, again, R30, 1/30th the heat getting to the surface passes through it, so you're reflecting 1/30th of the heat that you were losing back into the house, it's going to take a while to cost justify it.
Yeah, that's what I figured, but I was interested in your analysis.
Well, there are other places where the reflective insulation does work well. There's a lot of places where you can line an attic area and reduce a lot of the upper heat in the attic stays warmer, but then you end up usually not having the ventilation, which creates moisture problems. So while I will not say that reflective insulation doesn't work, because it does work and does have a place, but I'm not sure that residential construction is the most cost-effective place to put it.
Yeah. Would it actually be more effective if I had less insulation to put more of the fiberglass batting in?
In my opinion, cost-wise, yes. Because not necessarily batting, but if you've already got a fiberglass bat, I would recommend putting in a loose fill. Because the bats are hard to place tight together, so there's always little gaps, or if you have to go over an electrical wire, an air pocket underneath it. and the loose fill would go in there and cover all those little gaps and actually make your existing insulation a little bit more effective in addition to the whatever you put on top of it.
There's one place in the attic that I'm a little suspicious of. It's over a porch that originally wasn't enclosed, and then at some time in the past it was enclosed, but there was no insulation over it. And I put batting there. Would some kind of fill benefit there?
It depends on how tight you've got the bats. If you've got them very tight together, no gaps between them, then the amount that would it help is just going to be, okay, you put an 8-inch bat, or let's say you put a 6-inch bat up there, you could put another 3 or 4 inches, and we end up with a 9-inch or an R40, roughly. That would be helpful. The blowing in, like I say, it fills in the gaps. So I like a combination of the two. The fiberglass bat stays in place well, is not moved by air, so we can put those out by the soffit vents and such,
mm-hmm.
and then fill in everything else with a loose fill, and that way the air doesn't tend to blow the insulation back out. On my earlier caller with a cold spot where we may have had a vent or a soffit vent where some air was getting through and blowing the insulation out. So it's not a bad idea if you've got a fiberglass bat to put in a little bit of loose fill over the top of it. Like I say, it'll help pick up the efficiency or the effectiveness of your bat insulation, mm-hmm. as well as to add the extra insulation of the loose fill on top.
I've got an outside cellar stairway, and I'm thinking that it would be advantageous to seal that off during the winter with some kind of insulation that can be removed. I've been using an inch and a half foam board, or whatever you want to call it, the blue board type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an effective way of doing it?
If you've placed that on the outside of the cellar door or on the outside of the house, yes, that is a good way of doing it.
Well, this is underneath the cellar door.
Okay, that should be fine because then you've got a door down at the basement to close it off.
Yeah.
The foam insulation works quite well, particularly the blue board or the pink board, which is an extruded plastic so that it does not pick up moisture, does not hold moisture. I don't recommend its use inside the house because it is a flammable product.
Yes.
So as long as it's outside the house, it works well. You can use the foam insulation outside the house or under the house in crawl space areas, but I don't like it in living areas, quote unquote, because of the toxic fumes that can be produced if it were to smolder or catch on fire.
Well, thanks. You're always so very helpful.
All right.
Well, thank you.
We will continue, and our next caller is in St. Joe, line 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
This problem concerns a leak when the shower is used. The tub, the shower, the surround were installed about 20 years ago. There's a horizontal and then there's vertical seams in the shower surround. So recently I found a dampness on the floor on the two exposed sides of the tub. So I've removed and replaced the horizontal seal. And the vertical seals look good, but I still have dampness when the shower is used. I just wonder if you have any suggestions of how to determine the source of the leak and how to stop it.
Water leaks are very, very tricky because water will tend to wick away from the source. So it is oftentimes hard to find. You say you found water at the exposed ends.
Yeah, both on the side of the tub and at the one end of it, yeah.
The most common leaks, and I'm not going to say that's necessarily what you've got there because without really seeing it, I'm kind of guessing in the dark. The most common leaks for a tub, first of all, is improper use of a shower curtain, water getting around the shower curtain. The second one, depending on how old it is, most of the newer fiberglass tubs, the drain line connection to the tub is a rubber seal, which is put in compression with a collet. Basically, they have a piece where you slide the pipe into the rubber seal, and then you turn this ring, which then tightens the rubber seal. And over time, the rubber seal loses some of its oils and shrinks, and you end up some leakage around that rubber seal, and there's a way of tightening it or snugging it back up. It's very likely that you could be getting a little bit of water dripping around that drain that's landing on the subfloor, and working the subfloor is then just wicking the water out to where you can see it.
Yeah, well, we thought maybe that may be a problem, so we've been using it for tub baths. And so just using it as a tub, there's no problem. But just when the shower's used, though. And we put the splash guards, using the tub after when we put the horizontal, replace the horizontal seal. And I'm kind of going nuts. What am I going to do? The vertical seals look great. In fact, I thought, well, maybe I just need to put saran wrap on those or something like that to see if that's the cause, you know, but kind of my wit's end.
Well, that is something that you can do, is not necessarily a plastic wrap, but there are some tapes and such that you use temporarily. Put tape up a couple of seams and take your shower and see if you get the water and kind of narrow it down. Okay, what is not the cause?
Yeah.
Until you've located it.
Yeah. What kind of tape would you recommend for that? If
everything's good and clean, a good clear packing tape will work well and usually doesn't leave any residue when you pull it off, as long as you don't leave it there for extended periods of time.
Oh, okay. Hmm. So, well,
You could tape a piece of Visqueen up over the top of something, or use the tape itself as part of the seal. Anything temporary till you narrow it down and try and figure it. Usually, a shower leak like that is difficult to find, but I've also had instances where we've had the supply line inside the wall for the shower head had a very small leak. So when the shower was used, it actually ran down the copper line inside the wall.
Okay. And how do you get the heck out? I can't imagine that.
That's usually a matter of cutting open the closet or the wall or whatever it is that's behind the shower head, installing an access panel.
Jeez. That sounds like fun.
Well, the one I found was on a, would you believe, an 8x10 walk-in shower with four shower heads, and about halfway up one of the walls with 9-inch ceramic tiles, they had a leak. It turned into a major problem to get this figured out, but they did get it corrected.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. We'll continue here. Next caller in line is in Piatt County on our toll-free line 4 right here. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. We're building a house. Actually, it's a remodel, and it's an old house that we had looked at. It had no termite damage. And then we had it sited in cedar, but we did have a mouse problem, and we had a local company come out and put humane mouse trap things around. But they tried to sell us a big termite protection plan because of the cedar siding and the wood in the old structure. But I just question doing it in the winter now in the first place, and in the second place, if it hasn't had termite damage, is it worth to do a, you know, they want to sell you an 8-month or a 12-month termite plan. And so I'm just asking if you have any knowledge of that. Is it, if you don't have termites?
Well, I mean, some people are worried about termites and do preventive maintenance. Mm-hmm. My idea of preventive maintenance is take away the food source for the termites. And what mm-hmm. they want to eat is wet wood. They're not necessarily looking for dry wood. They're looking for wet mm-hmm. wood. So
okay.
as long as the house is relatively well sealed mm-hmm. from your cedar siding on the exterior of the house, you mm-hmm. should have 6 to 8 inches to the soil level where you can actually see part of the foundation.
Yes, we
do. As long as that foundation is exposed, the foundation is not food for the termites, so therefore when they go across it, they'll build little sand tubes to which will allow you to see that they're coming up into the house most of the time. Sometimes they can come inside a concrete block or something.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, unless you've got a moisture source or wet wood to attract the termites, I don't see that being proactive on it is going to be what you need to do. First of all, they don't eat cedar. The oils that are in the cedar, they don't like to eat. The cedar has its own natural preservatives in it with the oils,
mm-hmm.
Which the termites, I won't say they can't eat it. They just don't generally like it. Termites mm-hmm. are very picky about what they eat. I've watched them eat one entire ring out of a log because that year the tree grew faster, and so the wood was softer in that one ring, and literally cut a board in half without touching the rest of it. So they're looking for the easy meal, the sliced bread instead of the whole loaf. They want what they can get to. So as long as you keep things dry, that is probably your best proactive is no leaks.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your help.
All right. Thank you. Well, I think we certainly have time and lines here, about at least 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's with us once a month. It's always a Monday. We do these shows to give you the chance to ask these very kinds of questions. If you have some problem and you're not really quite sure how to solve it, give us a call and Scott will do his best to help you out. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We've had a couple of questions about insulation. In an attic, if you can get to it easily, it should be pretty easy to at least see how much insulation is there. You can go and you can just...
Yeah, usually there's an access that you can get to or a stairway where you can look at it. And the climate that we have around here with the current energy prices, they're looking at between an R35 or R38 and an R45, which is 9 to 10 inches, 12 inches if you can afford it. There are such thing as too much insulation, and that is where it starts blocking ventilation up into the attic. Since the slope portions of the roof are not insulated, we do need to be able to get some air movement up there so we don't get condensation inside the attic area. So when you start putting in additional insulation, one of the things you might want to do is locate your soffit vents and put in what they call an air chute, which is either a styrofoam or cardboard sleeve that will hold the insulation back from where that soffit area is so that your soffit ventilation can work in conjunction with your gable vents or your roof vents. So over-insulating an attic and actually stuffing an attic completely tight can create moisture problems in the attic. So the ventilation is still important. So over-insulation is a term that I use when somebody's gone up there and just sealed every little crack and nook all the way through this attic, and we're no longer getting any of our soffit ventilation up there, and we end up with creating other problems besides the heat loss. Mm.
So then if you're not really sure how much insulation, though, you have in your walls, how can you – I suppose one thing you could go around with is one of those heat reading things that you point at the wall and you can find – cold spots, but other than putting a hole in the wall so you can actually see what's in there, how do you know what's in there?
Oh, now you're asking me to give away home inspection secrets. I don't know about this, Dave. Yes, an IR gun, infrared temperature sensing gun, particularly the ones that have the little laser pointers so that you can actually see where physically see what space or areas that you're checking. Mm-hmm. We'll look for cold spots. I can usually find a cold spot in a wall the size of a softball, not necessarily much of anything smaller than that, but I can locate some places where insulation is missing or has settled. Usually when doing an inspection, it is frowned upon to go over to the wall and cut a 6-inch hole in the middle of it. And
probably most
inside.
People wouldn't. Yeah, they wouldn't go for that.
So what I try and do... it's not something for the non-mechanically inclined. I take the cover plate off of an electrical box, and usually there is a gap between the electrical box and the drywall where you can get inside the wall. Mm. And by using a thin 1/8-inch screwdriver, I can actually go outside the electric box. Do not stick the screwdriver into the electric box, but go along the outside of the electric box and into the wall and determine whether or not we've got, A, any insulation, B, how much insulation, an R7 bat or an R11 bat, or a loose fill or something like that. So with a little bit of practice, you can kind of feel. I remember some of the ones back in the early 80s and 90s where we had the Urey formaldehyde foam, which is it was basically like a dried shaving cream. As soon as you stuck the screwdriver in there, it kind of fell apart and came out as a powder. Kind of interesting stuff to try and figure out. But with a little bit of practice, you can say, yes, I've got X amount of insulation in the walls.
Okay. Well, I've got some other callers here, and we'll go next and talk with somebody in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Several callers back when they first got on the insulation theme, you went immediately to the economics of insulation, and I would just like to encourage you to do more like you did the last caller, talk about the practical difficulties in doing it rather than the economics, because the truth of the matter is one can't accurately plan the economics of it over the lifetime of the investment in the insulation. So we've tripled the cost of electricity here in the last year, and what was economic 2 years ago in insulation, the picture's totally changed. And I think we ought to be pushing the envelope in figuring out ways of insulating more and dealing with the moisture problems and so on, because it's simply the right thing to do for the environment. And the economics over the long haul will take care of themselves, because generally you're making an investment that's going to be there for 40, 50, 60 years.
Well, yes, you're correct. And let's face it, back in the 40s, it was more expensive to buy insulation than it was to buy heating fuel. So therefore, that's why we have a bunch of houses that had absolutely no insulation. And as the prices go up, the insulation is more and more attractive. I believe the point I was trying to make with our earlier caller was that you can get to the point where you're adding enough insulation because the insulation value is an inverse proportion to heat loss. Once you're trying to reduce your heat loss by 1/40th, it depends on how much money you're spending on to save that 1/40th. 25 years down the road, yes, the energy costs are enough that may be justifiable. But at this point, a lot of the construction I see these days, I'm not sure is going to make much more than 25 years. We're not building houses that last 100 years or 200 years any longer.
I would like to suggest that, you know, perhaps there be a theme on a given month on energy conservation and appropriate energy conservation, because people are listening who are buying new houses and they don't know how to look at the shoddy construction of these. And to inspect it as it's going up to make sure that it's sealed properly. And then most of us live in older homes where it's not a question of spending $300,000 to spend $200 a month, as your scenario you suggested there about 20 minutes back.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about spending $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 and spending maybe now $200 a month for 4 months out of the year. But with the trajectory of energy costs and global warming and so on, it just seems like $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 investment in tightening up our homes and making them more energy efficient is the thing we ought to be encouraging. It's not a question of $300,000 to retrofit. No one is.
Well, you're correct. I was going a little overboard there, but it was just to show a point that there is such a way of trying to over-insulate it. Insulation is definitely a good idea. And, of course, more insulation is more energy efficient and better for everybody. But at this point in time, if you've got an older house that has 3.5-inch walls, to completely clad the house with another 4 inches of insulation is probably not practical. From an economical standpoint, or even from how much energy or how tight am I going to make the house? So, I mean, there are ways of going overboard, and your $5,000 is probably a little high. Most houses can have a lot of insulation added for less than $1,000 if they the older houses that have very little insulation. But I believe my caller was trying to make a house that he didn't have to heat because he was going to use the ground as the heat source. And to get that much insulation on an existing structure, I think, is going to be cost prohibitive. You can build the new house with the better insulation for what it's going to cost you to retrofit the old house.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that the caller and you are both right in the sense that there were probably a lot of older homes that could certainly benefit by additional insulation.
Definitely.
And that would be a way to not only make that home more comfortable to live in, but reduce energy consumption in a way that within a relatively short period of time, you'd at least break even on your investment. If that was the if the money wasn't the most important thing to you, then you'd say, well, even if I break even is good, or even if it pays it back in 5 years or 10 years, that's good.
I actually, if I find a house that has an R11 or basically a 3.5-inch fiberglass bat in the attic, I consider that to be a fairly significant deficiency because the insulation is going to pay for itself very quickly. You can cut energy bills almost in half by adding another 8 to 10 inches of insulation over it. And insulation, 1,000 square foot of insulation in an accessible attic, you're probably spending less than $400 to have it added in.
Yeah. So we have an off-air question here. Somebody has a house that has blown-in cellulose. It's been there for, say, 20 years. They feel that should be good. However, there's some concern, particularly about whether over time that is going to compact. And then so that might end up with you'd have a wall that was pretty much good, but then you might have a cold spot, say, at the top.
That is correct, and I have seen walls where we've pulled drywall off of existing houses and seen the evidence of the insulation settlement. Kind of depends on who installed it and how versed they were as getting insulation in. Most of the guys that install it on a regular basis were pretty good at getting the wall fairly full without blowing the wall board back off on the inside, which it sounds humorous.
You've actually seen that happen?
Actually, I had a friend of mine, and I'm hoping he's not listening, who blew the insulation in himself and managed to overfill the wall enough that it pushed the drywall off the nails inside, and he promptly filled half his living room with cellulose insulation. So, yes, you could put too much in the wall and try and make it too tight to where the nails no longer hold the drywall on. And this was just done this last year, so it's not something that was done back in the 70s when it was added.
Let's try and get one more at least here. Line number two is Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, this is more of a summertime question. For a house that does not currently have a whole house-type fan, and the only venting in the attic is a ridge vent. There are no eaves, just a ridge vent. I assume you could put vents in the gable ends. I'm concerned about, since there's really no overhang on this particular house, if you cut vents for the ends to exhaust the whole house fan, that it may get water in there, or, you know, are the louvers sufficient to keep rain from blowing into an attic?
Most of the louver systems are pretty good at keeping moisture out. I mean, when you put them in, you flash them correctly. They've got enough of a downslope that water won't drip inside. So, yes, that is a very real possibility. If you've got a house that's designed with little or no soffit, or the soffit was never intended or designed for ventilation, some type of cross ventilation is very helpful. The ridge vent is not necessarily a cure-all. It's something that works in almost all cases, but not a 100% cure-all. A ridge vent without an air source at the bottom, either a soffit vent or a gable vent, isn't going to be very effective, because what the ridge vent does is vents out hot air rising. Well, the hot air is only going to rise if there's cool air to come in from underneath to replace it.
Right.
To work on your convection. So, yes, gable end vents can be used. You say there's no ventilation there at the bottom at all that you're
absolutely
aware of?
Absolutely none. There's no soffit. The roof just meets the house, kind of.
Okay.
In fact, previously, there was a new roof installed recently, and previous to that, there was no venting in the attic of any kind at all.
Okay. Was there any deterioration of the plywood, molding, darkening the sheathings, things like that?
I think there had been some, yeah.
Yeah. Those are all indications of a lack of ventilation. So the ridge vent with some gable vents would probably be your best bet.
Okay, and you don't really have to worry, even though there's no particular overhang on this, and it's essentially putting the gable vent in just a vertical wall with no overhang, you don't have to worry about rain getting into it.
Most of the older houses were ventilated just that exact same way.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, well, we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month. We do this always on Monday, take questions about home maintenance. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, David. I'm going to have to go home and do a little bit of homework, so when I come in next time, we can do a little bit more with some tankless water heaters.
Tankless water heaters, all right.